You're listening to the ANA Podcast Network, powered by Audacy, a leading multi-platform audio content and entertainment company. Listen on the Audacy app.
For Beyond Profit, a podcast of the ANA Center for Brand Purpose, I'm Ken Beaulieu. Meeta Malik, head of inclusion, equity, and impact at the technology company Carta, is a big believer in the power of many. Specifically, bringing leaders together with different cultural backgrounds and different points of view in life experiences. It's the surest way, she says, for an organization to authentically and purposefully serve customers and communities. But if only it were so easy. Transforming a workplace to improve inclusivity at every level can be a challenging endeavor, but it's one that the most purposeful companies have made a priority, and it's helping them build a culture where employees can thrive. In her new book, Reimagine Inclusion, Meeta debunks 13 myths that hold companies back from transforming their workplaces. Through powerful storytelling, she offers practical and effective strategies for building more inclusive, empathetic, and resilient organizations, and explains the ripple effect that can have on systems, processes, and policies. Meeta, who has a long track record of transforming businesses and cultures, joins me to discuss key learnings from her book, Why Unconscious Bias Holds Companies Back, The Rise of DEI Backlash, and much more. Meeta, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So talk about perfect timing for the release of your book in light of all the conversations around inclusion and DEI. But what prompted you to write the book, especially now?
Well, it's either the worst time or the best time to publish a book on inclusion. And people ask me, why did you publish this now? Well, I finally got a book deal. There's a whole story around the inequities I faced in publishing. But I wrote this book because I wanted to say the quiet parts out loud of what holds us back from making meaningful progress in our workplaces. And Ken, I thought a little bit about the stories we tell our kids at bedtime, or I tell my kids at bedtime. And I thought, what are the stories we tell ourselves at work that just aren't true? Sometimes they're powerful stories. Sometimes they're exciting or dramatic stories. And you're like, yeah, that's actually not true. And if I believe that, it's holding me back from building a more inclusive workplace. And so that is the angle I took for this book.
Were you nervous at all? I mean, did you feel like this was somewhat of a risk on your part because you're putting yourself out there?
Yes, absolutely. But I also believe with the platform I've grown, with power comes responsibility, power, privilege to share the things that other people aren't sharing. Because I always say we can't change what we don't discuss. And so some of the things as I wrote them down, I thought, yeah, I'm going to publish it. I'm going to say that. And it's been received really well from people who really care about this work and for people who are curious and want to understand what they can be doing personally to build a more inclusive and resilient culture. What's their part in their workplace?
So as I mentioned at the top, your book debunks 13 myths about inclusion. Is there a particular myth that you find especially frustrating and difficult to set straight?
Gosh, there's so many. Where do we start? Well, for this audience, I am a marketer and a storyteller. One of the ones that always baffled me was our ad wasn't racist. It was simply a mistake. And so often working in organizations and building amazing, powerful brands, they're going to be mistakes. Because guess who runs the brands? Human beings like you and me. We all make mistakes. And the inability to accept responsibility and accountability for some of those mistakes always baffled me. Because if we can't actually accept, Ken, that our actions may have been received as racist, they are racist, homophobic, sexist, how can we actually learn and do better and be better? And so if you stay in that state of denial, it always baffled me working on big brands and small brands. I get a lot of calls now from companies. What do I do next? Apologize. Own your mistake. That's the first thing. And then we'll talk about the rest. But that always really baffled me, still baffles me to this day.
I mean, I've read studies. I've talked to experts who say the same thing, that consumers are willing to give you the benefit of the doubt. They're willing to forgive you if you're just transparent.
Yes.
And yet it's still bothers companies to go out on a limb and say that.
You know why I think that might be? Certainly as a marketer, I was raised somewhat to be arrogant. And that might sound, she's actually saying that. But why do I mean that? Because as a marketer, I'm supposed to know you so well, Ken. I'm supposed to surprise and delight you with the product or service you never expected. Like, we are in many ways anthropologists. We're studying cultures and then trying to figure out how we can enhance the quality of your life. And when you say to me, well, Mita, the ad you put out was racist, you're actually telling me I can't do my job. I don't know how to serve this community. And I got it completely wrong. And that's really hard to hear, particularly in a paradigm that's now shifting. I mean, I was raised in a corporate America where the leader was always right. The leader had all the answers. And so we don't show vulnerability. That's weakness. We don't admit to our failures. We bury them. So I think all these things are colliding right now. And I hope with the new generation that's coming into the workplace, they change that for the better.
So as you're well aware, unconscious bias is a huge barrier to diversity and inclusion in the workplace. So while everyone within an organization should really own that, right? Be accountable for driving inclusivity. Talk about the importance of, you know, senior leadership and the managers really taking the ball and running with it.
It's role modeling. It's role modeling. It's so important. I, at a junior level, and I always talk about the frozen middle in a company, right? All the managers are there. We can be doing all the work, but if the CEO and the C-suite don't care, what signal is that sending? Mm-hmm. If they're not stopping some of the things that they're seeing in their organization that should not be happening, behaviors that are just not tolerated, or when a racist incident happens or a DE&I crisis happens, which we'll all be faced with, people look to leadership to see what they're going to do next. How are they going to represent the company? How are they going to lead? That's so important. And it's not to say that I firmly believe that anybody in an organization can be making change. Too often in my career, I waited for the CEO to do something, right? The CEO should be doing something, but also ask yourself, what are you doing? What are you doing personally to show up every day and build a more inclusive workplace?
It sounds to me you're also suggesting that this is not necessarily an HR-only initiative or a marketing. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. You know, I work with too many leaders who are like, oh, waiting for the CEO to send the note out. And we can pick up our phones today. There's another crisis happening in the world. We are so globally connected now. It is difficult to know, unless you know your teams well, how different things in the world, horrific acts, crisis, are impacting someone day to day. You're waiting for the CEO to send a note out. I'll put that to the parking lot for a second. But what are you doing about it? Am I checking in on Ken? I just watched the news today, Ken. And I remember you had family in Texas and there was a school shooting. Like, I'm just thinking about you. And Ken might say, actually, you know, I grew up in that area, or thanks for thinking of me. Thanks for remembering that fact about me. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's like, if you know your teams well enough, you can check in on them and have these conversations. You don't need to wait for the CEO to send a note to do that.
Has it been your experience, Mita, that employees find it difficult to have those conversations, not only with their bosses, but with senior leadership?
Absolutely. I often think about my father, rest in peace, when I was growing up. He would have his tea and toast in the morning, read the Boston Globe, go to work, come home at 6 p.m. and scream at my brother and I to get off the TV. We're watching cartoons so he could watch the national news, right? His life was so different than mine. There was a clear line where work ended and life began. There's no line anymore. And Paul Pullman, who's the former Unilever of CEO to work for, he used to say, there's no line where Unilever ends and society begins. And that's how he ran the company. And that was his vision. But many leaders can still live in that old paradigm. We shouldn't talk about religion, sex, politics. We shouldn't talk about any of these things at work. And the more particularly as you look at Generation Z entering the workforce, they actually want to be having these discussions around their values and their life experiences. And many leaders, as you're saying, they're not equipped, they're not prepared, or they're burying their head in the sand and saying, this does not belong at work. Mm-hmm. But we have to adapt for a new way of working because now there's no line anymore. And so that's what I think is really tripping up leaders. If you can't get over that, right? If you can't get over that hurdle, then you're actually not going to have these conversations because you're like, this doesn't belong at work.
So you have said, Mita, that diversity of thought doesn't happen without diversity of representation. So I'm hoping you can elaborate a little bit on that insight.
It is. Inclusion is a competitive driver of the business. So no matter what industry sector you're sitting in, no matter what you're doing, you are trying to beat competition. You are selling something to somebody, right? If you are in for profit, you are trying to generate and drive revenue. And how do you get the most amazing ideas? You get them from brainstorming, and you get them when you have lots of different views and life perspectives and thoughts around the table colliding and clashing to come up with that one great idea. And so you think about right now, Procter & Gamble, one source tells us there's over $5 trillion of spending power with the multicultural consumer in the U.S. today. That doesn't include veterans, individuals with disabilities, the LGBTQ plus community, and more. You think about all these different dimensions of diversity, and you're thinking about money that's being left on the table and how we're not authentically in serving those communities. But if I don't understand the lived experience of what it means to be a veteran in this country, how can I serve that community if I don't have that experience at the table? And so that is why inclusion is the unlock to innovation. To me, it seems so clear. You look at the data, you look at how quickly the demographics of this country are changing. Right now, we're at 40% of individuals in the U.S. identify as non-white. That number's rapidly increasing. You're like, wow, I want all these insights in my workforce so I can drive my business. And that to me is very clear. And what I find very interesting about this time is that I feel like we're back to sharing the business case for diversity. I was on stage recently and I said, I'm going to talk about the business case for diversity. And someone said, please God, don't. And I said, well, it's too late. I have the microphone. And it might sound like we're back in 2000, but this is where we are right now, is talking about the numbers again.
Right. So you mentioned, Mita, that you're a marketer. Do you think, yes, the marketing industry has made significant strides in this area of inclusion?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm a half glass person. I like to stay optimistic. I have to. That's why I do this work. Certainly from when I was growing up, right? I think about the beauty industry, which is the industry I joined. I couldn't find any shades of anything that worked on my skin tone. And now you think about how the, let's say, even the hair care industry, you look at the target aisle 10 years ago, that being dominated by really large players. And what's happening now? I can't even count how many brands on Instagram every day pop up in beauty. And you're like, why? And so many of these founders that I interview for my entrepreneur column, many of, particularly women of color, will say, I worked at a large company and they didn't like my ideas and I knew there was a market. So I'm going to go launch this hair care product. I'm going to go launch this lipstick line that works for my skin tone. And so I do think there are so many amazing startups and smaller brands who are challenging some of these really large behemoths that have been, particularly from my view, let's say in the beauty industry, for so long. And so many of them, like, wow. And so now they're either acquiring them or following suit. They're like, wow. And, you know, Rihanna's Fenty, which gets a lot of credit as it should. I mean, just that launch a few years ago just showed you how there's such a demand in the marketplace for products that benefit particularly darker skin tones like myself.
You've made it known, Mita, that you were bullied as a kid because of the color of your skin and the fact that your parents spoke, quote unquote, funny English. Can you just talk a bit about how that difficult time, you know, served as a springboard to your important work now?
Thank you for that question. I am the proud daughter of Indian immigrant parents. And I, as you say, grew up in a time and a place where it wasn't cool to be Indian. I was the dark-skinned, funny-looking girl with a long, funny-looking braid whose parents spoke funny English until it wasn't funny anymore. And I was bullied a lot, both verbally and physically, growing up. And I always say this work ended up finding me because I know what it's like not to be included. We don't talk about exclusion a lot. And I think anyone listening here today to this conversation, I want you to think about that. I think anybody listening can pull up a memory of when they feel like they didn't belong, whether it was kickball in elementary school, a story I share in Reimagine Inclusion. Maybe it's a friend's birthday. You thought you were friends. You weren't invited. It was a meeting where you did all the work. They didn't invite you. I mean, anyone can draw on that. It's a really painful emotion. And so most of us would never intentionally want anyone to feel that way. And so I never can anticipated that the bullies from the schoolyards and classrooms would follow me into corporate America, but that's certainly what happened. And when people say to me, God, you're so empathetic, I'm like, no, I wasn't born empathetic. It's just through all these experiences that I've gained, and I'm on a journey to gain a stronger sense of empathy, because I think, wow, if I've been through this, I'm not alone. I know other people have had these experiences. And so I try to be more aware of that in my work.
You make such an amazing point, Mita, talking about it's not only about inclusion, but thinking about exclusion. I haven't heard that before. And again, going back to being a marketer, is that something that marketers should be thinking about as they're coming up with their plans?
Absolutely. If you tell me there's no growth to be had, if you're struggling with growth, I'm going to ask you, who are you excluding, intentionally or unintentionally? I have been in too many rooms, Ken, I'll share, early on in my career. I remember being in a meeting where all the mood boards were of white models. The concept was including only white models. And I thought, and I asked the question, like, you know, all these shades are for lighter skin tones. Why aren't we thinking about a shade of foundations for darker skin tones? Because no one will buy it. Well, you have made that decision. You actually don't know that's the case. And so really stop and ask yourself, and it starts at the conference room table, meaning it starts with who's sitting around the table ideating, because I only know my lived experience. You only know your lived experience. And if you're on a journey to be a more inclusive leader and be more empathetic, you might have access to other people's lived experiences. But if you aren't creating a team where people are thinking about all the different consumers and all the different communities, you're not going to get to a place where you are serving communities you didn't expect to serve, generating more revenue, driving growth, if you're not thinking about that from the start.
Hello, Beyond Profit listener. System One, a creative effectiveness platform that helps marketers predict and improve the commercial impact of their ads, just released an important new report titled The Greenprint USA. Among the report's chief findings, just 2.6% of U.S. ads over the past 3 years contain any environmental messaging. And when they do, they're no more effective than the average ad at driving long-term brand growth. That's a problem. To change that, the Greenprint USA report offers a treasure trove of guidance on how brands can create effective environmental ads. For example, tell stories over stats. Indeed, individual stories are much more powerful and memorable than abstract or statistical information because they elicit feelings. The Greenprint USA report is rooted in behavioral science and provides 6 big insights in related case studies to help you create ads with sustainability messaging that will drive growth and inspire consumer behavior change. Speaking of which, System One's creative effectiveness platform tests nearly every ad airing on TV to see how the creative makes viewers feel. And here's the key learning. Ads that evoke intense positive emotions in people are more effective at driving long-term brand building and short-term sales. To download the Greenprint USA report, visit systemonegroup.com/greenprint. That's systemonegroup.com/greenprint. And now, back to the show. So I'm speaking today with Mita Malik, Head of Inclusion, Equity, and Impact at Carter and author of Reimagine Inclusion. So Mita, it is your belief that a company can only claim to be purpose-led if it has an inclusive work culture. Why is that?
I go back to the innovation and who are you serving and why? Where is this idea of purpose coming from? And it's very interesting, like purpose for who? Isn't that also coded language? Like my purpose is different than your purpose. And you're like, well, are you actually putting your employees at the heart of that? I always say employees are a forgotten consumer. We spend so much time thinking about who we're going to sell, how much to where, when, and why. But who's driving the purpose of the company? It is the employees. The employees and the company are not two different things. They are one and the same. And so the purpose of a company is actually, I believe, built by the employees. And the question is, who is the employee base? And actually, you could have diversity of representation of the employee base, but actually, do you care what they think? Mm-hmm. I always joke, I've been given a seat plenty of times at a table, but no one wanted to hear what I thought, right? It was like, just sit there. It was sort of like Thanksgiving, Ken, U.S. Thanksgiving, where it's like, there's the kids table and there's the, okay, you can come in, but go sit at the kids table. We actually don't want to hear what you have to say. And so that's why I think those two things are very connected.
So I 100% agree with you that employees are your most important stakeholder. But why is it so difficult for organizations to activate purpose internally?
Because they don't believe what you and I just said. They don't believe that their employees are their most important stakeholder. They believe it's the stock price. They believe it's the shareholders. They believe it's the customers. They believe in terms of private companies, it's the investors. I'm not saying that those stakeholders aren't important. I'm saying if we think about it as a circle, those individuals are all equally important. But employees are generally left off the list. It's like always the afterthought. But imagine if you spent the time thinking of your employees as one of your most important constituents and consumers, imagine how loyal they would be, how fiercely they would defend you, how much they would advocate for you. Mm-hmm. These are all things that would happen naturally. When I work for companies where I feel seen, valued, I belong, you don't have to ask me to talk about it. I'm going to do it anyways. You don't have to ask me to advertise your products. You don't have to ask me to talk about some of the important work we're doing in the marketplace. You don't have to ask me twice. And so if people could think about it that way, it would really lift everything that you're working on.
You are, Mita, a proud storyteller. You say that
I am.
In your bio on LinkedIn, wherever. So how has the power of storytelling helped you demystify the myths about inclusion?
When you read Reimagine Inclusion, I hope you'll all pick it up, Reimagine Inclusion, Debunking 13 Myths to Transform Your Workplace. I start every chapter with a powerful story, which may or may not have happened in corporate America. And many people read these stories and they're like, that was my story. I'm like, it's also my story too. Why? Marketers know this. Stories have the power to change, inspire, transform workplaces, people's lives, communities, our world. And so stories capture the heart. And then I can capture the heart, then I can get to the head and say, okay, now here's all the facts and the data and the research behind it. And so that's why I think stories are so important. And it is the oldest form of communicating in mm-hmm. human civilization. And so mm-hmm. stories can really drive change.
It sounds to me like there's a certain art and science to storytelling as well.
There is. People ask me, how do you write so much? And I'm like, well, I spend 20 minutes a day at least writing. There's discipline. It's like half art, half discipline. Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff will never see the light of day. It goes into the trash, and that's okay. I'm doing it to get better. And part of it is discipline, and part of it is the art, the practice of it, but also being aware of marketers. This is our number one job, to look at insights. Human truths, like what's happening in the marketplace, what's happening in your home, what's happening in your community. There's stories everywhere all the time that we can be sharing.
Well, you mentioned earlier about DEI backlash. I want to get into that now. So there are companies out there like Google, Meta, who have slashed their DEI programs. So from your perspective, what are the major issues at play?
One of the major issues at play is that these roles were never set up for success. They were in reaction to the diversity tipping point of May 2020, which my friend DC Marshall of Diverse and Engaged has coined. It is the during the period of the murder of George Floyd, where companies say Black lives do matter, and made a lot of commitments and promises. They put individuals like myself into chief diversity officer roles without budget, without real decision-making power, without metrics. They were window dressing. They were left on their own to try to accomplish things that were impossible without a support system. And then there were individuals who were placed and did have support, but that support over time has crumbled. And part of why I think that's happened is that inclusion is a driver of the business, but we never built it into the business. And so what do I mean by that? Does your chief diversity officer have a seat at the table when it comes to products and services? I certainly do. You must. Do they have that lens? When you think about people processes, are you thinking about beyond recruiting? Are you also thinking about, hey, let's talk about performance improvement plans? We don't talk about that a lot, but like who has the opportunity to make more mistakes and why? Why do we hold different people to different standards? Like, am I more likely to put Ken on a PIP faster than Mita? And why is that? Like, do we think about how all of our processes are fair and equitable? Do we think about supplier diversity? I worked for many, a big public company, as you know, Ken, and we wrote the same several million dollar checks to the same people. Right? Why? Mm-hmm. Why aren't we thinking about more small-owned businesses? Why aren't we thinking about supporting different people in the ecosystem? And then the values piece, I will tell you, I mean, we're in 2024 now, but it's there has been a lot that's happened over the last year and a half and continues to happen, particularly from a U.S. perspective. Are you equipped to be talking about these things at work? Are you equipped to be taking a stand as a company? Because more and more, as you know, across generations, consumers are voting with their wallets and employees will do the same. They'll vote with their feet. If they feel that a company is not aligned to their values, they will go work elsewhere as soon as they have the power to do so.
Are you fearful that other companies will follow suit in terms of the, you know, slashing their DEI programs?
I think the market will bifurcate.
Yeah.
You will have companies who will continue to double down on diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. Many companies are still doing that. Then you have companies on the tech side, Coinbase, Basecamp. There are so many companies who have said DEI efforts very clearly, like, don't matter here. We don't want them here. We're not going to talk about them. Politics doesn't belong at work. And so the market will bifurcate and you'll have companies plotted along the way. And the employee base is quickly shifting in this country. And so people will vote. People will vote with their wallets and they will work where they feel recognized, seen, and valued. That is exactly what will happen. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not worried about it. I actually think, you know, the companies that are doubling down, the marketers who are listening today, good for you, because inclusion is a competitive advantage. It's a driver of the business. You will actually outperform your competition. So stay the course. Let everyone else do what they're doing, but you stay the course because you'll win at the end.
Perhaps we haven't beat the drum loud enough for that.
I hope. Yeah. I'm ready to do it with you, Ken.
There we go. Lastly, Mita, what's your advice for someone listening today on how they can show up differently to work tomorrow?
I love that question. Be the reason someone feels value, seen, and recognized. Be that person. We're all concerned about ourselves. We should be. But if you're at work tomorrow and someone's been taken off a project, or someone seems quieter than usual, or someone seems disengaged, are you checking in on them? Are you asking them what's happening? Are you actually taking an active role to build a more inclusive workforce? And I think too many of us, I've certainly been guilty of this. I'm just busy with my head down working. Look up and around and check in on each other. We spend too much time at work not to.
What great advice. Thank you. Mita Malik, thank you so much for joining me on Beyond Profit. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was a great conversation, Ken.
If you would like to obtain a copy of Reimagine Inclusion, please visit Amazon.com and be sure to check out Mita's LinkedIn page. And for more information on Carta, visit Carta.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.
This has been a presentation of the ANA Podcast Network, powered by Audacy.